Okay. Quick recap for those of you who weren't here, and just to bring us all onto the same page. Previously, we saw that the Sanhedrin is incapable of being mature or reaching consensus on justice in the case of Paul. And of course, they would end up being the losers. And of course, they would end up being very frustrated with Paul. Why? Because they are fighting against God. When you fight against God, if you end up in a situation where you get frustrated, you must know, you know, who am I fighting against here? They don't get it. We see them clearly on the wrong side the moment that they are willing to lie in a plot to have Paul assassinated and ambushed on the way from his prison to the chamber of hewn stone. But God is always five steps ahead. Their plot comes to light through the intervention of God through Paul's nephew. I call him one of the no-name brands of the Bible. I want to do a series of sermons one day on the no-name people in the Bible that made an impact. Isn't that cool? I mean, our names aren't written in the Bible. That doesn't mean God can't use us powerfully in his kingdom, right? So his name is not mentioned, but he plays a pivotal role in this wonderful story. Now, when Lysias, the commander, hears about this escalating problem, that now it's not just the Sanhedrin and the Jews struggling with him. Now these guys, they want to kill Paul. And they're threatening to kill Roman soldiers in the process as well, because Roman soldiers would be walking with Paul, taking him from one place to the other. He says, okay, we need to upgrade this situation. This is out of hands. We need to send Paul to Caesarea. Okay, and we have to make sure that he is secure, and so he basically gets an army and he sends him to Felix. All right. So there Felix would call the Sanhedrin to come and make their case before him, and he becomes the new judge. And as I said last week, it's like we are sending somebody to Salem to go stand in front of Tina Kotek. Okay, that's sort of the same thing. Felix is sort of the governor, and he can make the call better. So he's upgrading this to a high level of authority. I find it interesting that 480 people needs to protect Paul from 40 guys. God provides 10 times more protection when we are in any sort of trouble. And if you want to hear more about that, you can go look at last week's lesson. And then what is pretty cool to me as well that I sort of ended off with last week is that Felix takes Paul and places him in Herod's palace. Now, Herod didn't make small palaces. Here he goes, protected by a pagan army, and he lives in Herod's palace. That's pretty cool. Meanwhile, what's the Sanhedrin doing? That's sort of where we're going to start tonight. Because what we're going to see tonight is we're going to see the court case. We're going to see the Sanhedrin facing Paul in front of Felix. That's what the whole chapter 24 is about. We're going to make a lot of progress tonight. Very cool story. I enjoyed it when I read it. Let's get into it. 5 days later. So Paul has been in Herod's palace for 5 days. Okay. The high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. So what have they been doing these 5 days? They've been scurrying to get a lawyer. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that so American? We get lawyers. So first there's riots, then there's assassination, and they try everything. They want to get this guy, and now they get a lawyer. The Greek word doesn't really say that he's a lawyer, but he is a one that is good with his mouth. Isn't that exactly what a lawyer is? He's a rhetorician. He's an orator. He can use his mouth. They needed somebody that could stand up against Paul. Paul was being driven and moved and used by God as a speaking tool for him, as a mouthpiece for him. And they didn't know how to handle this guy because he's incredible with his mouth. So verse 2 in the original language really says, I've highlighted it there for charges, and they brought their charges. And then it says when Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. What it really says there in the Greek is that he brought his accusation against Paul. He came to accuse Paul. And whenever this word kategorio is used, it's a dead giveaway on whose side you are. Because what do we know clearly about the Bible? What does the Bible say Satan does? What's his fundamental goal in life? Is to accuse. He's the accuser. That's what Revelation calls him as well. So Satan accuses, Jesus exonerates. You've always got to be very careful of accusing people. Be very careful of that, and we'll talk about it a little bit later. The moment you get yourself, you want to start pointing fingers, be careful. Pause for a moment. Rather give grace. Exonerate people instead of trying to bind them. Set people free instead of trying to imprison them. And that's where you see the difference between Satan and Jesus. All right, let's continue. So this is Tertullus now. This is the speech of the great hired lawyer orator. He starts, "We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent, Felix. We acknowledge this with profound gratitude." You see why they hired him? This is a smooth talker, man. "But in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to just, you know, hear us briefly." You know, we don't waste much of your time, okay? Now that it's sort of like the tone changes when he starts talking to Paul about Paul. "We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple, so we seized him." Then there's a verse that's not in most of the translation because many of the earliest manuscripts do not have it in there. Maybe it's in your Bible, but I didn't put it in. Verse 8 then says, "By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him." So what does this guy do? His first opportunity to speak. He praises Felix. So he's such a good guy, man. "You provide so well. You provide well for us. You know, we're happy. You give us peace. Therefore, we are very thankful. Good job, man." He's patronizing the guy. And then from praise, he moves over to becoming very considerate. You know, we don't want to waste your time. We want you to feel relaxed, and we want to get this off your plate quickly. Let's resolve it quickly. He's winning this guy over. He's clever. He knows what he's doing. All right? So he's very diplomatic. Very diplomatic. And that is why he was hired, right? He's a politician, isn't he? He's pretty good. So his job is to convince the governor that Paul is a problem that deserves death. But he tries to soften Felix. He praises him, and then he shows respect for him by respecting his time and his space and his energy. But here we find another dead giveaway. History tells us that Felix was an evil man. This governor was not a good man. So Tertullian is praising an evil man. I'll give you some history. This guy, this Felix, he arranged the assassination of the next high priest after Annas. His name was Jonathan. He had him killed in the temple area by a dagger man while he was performing sacrifices. He was cruel. He liked bribes, as you will see tonight. A Roman historian described Felix as, uses three words for him: cruel, licentious, and base. When he arrived in Judea, he became attracted to Drusilla. Drusilla was the daughter of Herod Agrippa. Herod Agrippa was the Herod that was eaten by worms in Acts chapter 12. So he fell in love with this woman, but she was already married to a man by the name of Azizus. But he didn't care. And he found a way to snatch her, she was about 20 years old, from his hands, and he married her. So what you have standing in front of Paul here, this man is a murderer, he's a liar, he's a briber, he's an ungodly man, he's an adulterer. All the worst types of sins is encapsulated in this guy. And Tertullus, he doesn't care about the moral standing of this guy. He just wants to win him over to get Paul killed and get Paul into trouble. But then Tertullus, he goes on and he talks about Paul. And he says three interesting things about Paul. The Greek word, first Greek word he uses there is loimos. This guy literally is a plague and a pest or a disease. Would you find it insulting when somebody says that to you? You're a parasite. You're a rat. You're a pest. You are corona to me. You give me sickness. And then he calls him an insurrectionist. He says he stirs up riots all over the world. Now, we've been studying this. We've read about all these riots. Quick question. Did Paul start the riots? People were rioting because they hated Paul. Well, they didn't hate Paul. They hated a message that came out of his mouth. And then they wanted to shoot the messenger. And then, thirdly, they call him a prostatites, a ringleader. And I loved it when I looked at this word because it literally means he is the champion. That's what it means. He's a champion of the Nazarite sect. That's the accusation. Well, you can call me that any day. What an incredible insult. I champion Jesus Christ of Nazareth. So they got that right. So they climb into Paul's character. Do you see that? They praise this evil man. When they get to Paul, they break him down. And they climb into his character. They hate him as a person. They have nothing good to say about him. But there isn't an actual crime with proof. Do you pick that up? What's the crime? There's no crime. It's like, this guy is an insurrectionist. This guy is a ringleader. This guy is a plague, a pest. What's the accusation? I mean, this is a court case, right? Well, he then does bring up the crime. Did you pick it up in the text? He says he tried to actively desecrate the temple. If there's one crime in the text, it's probably that, right? He tried to desecrate the temple. Well, where does that come from? Acts 21, 29. We've dealt with this previously. This is the time when they arrested him. They had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with Paul and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple. That's the only thing in Acts that you can pick up that's going on here. So they assumed that Paul had brought a Gentile, uncircumcised Gentile, into the temple. There's no evidence. So it's all assumption. It's interesting when I thought about this, and I find that in my life as well, and maybe in your life too. If you don't like someone, you always assume the worst of them. Assumption is a bad thing. Now, you and I know, when you read Acts, when you read the letters of Paul, it wasn't in his nature to disrespect the Jewish law. Right? He wanted to set people free from the law, that's true. But he wasn't in the business of trying to destroy it. When he was going to deal with many Jews and didn't want to offend him, and he had Timothy with him, what did he do with Timothy? Knowing that Timothy is a Greek and it's going to be a challenge to take him into synagogues, he had him circumcised. Paul was always thinking about how the Jews would feel. He's trying his best. He was not on trial here because he was in some way totally disrespectful towards the Jewish faith. He was on trial because of the resurrection of the dead that he believed in and Jesus Christ. When he came to Jerusalem, he didn't want trouble with the people. Remember what happened? And he came to the elders and the elders said, listen, let's find a way to make it as peaceful as possible. Go do the sacrifices in the temple with these Nazarite guys. And he did that. And that's actually where they arrested him. So there's something else at work here. Anyway, so Tertullus had his speech now. Okay, what happens next? This is a funny verse for me. Verse 9. The other Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true. I can imagine like sort of in the corner over there, there's a few passionate, zeal-filled Jews that came with these leaders, the top guns. And they sort of standing there, little raggedy Jews in the corner and shouting there, yeah, it's true, it's true, it's true. And nothing they say really matters, but they They're trying to just support what is going on there. So, let's go on to the next verses. Verse 10. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied. So this is Paul's turn to speak. You know what's beautiful about this? Paul actually gets a turn to speak. And let's look at what Paul says. I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. Do you notice that he's not kissing this guy's feet? He's very neutral, right? I know you've been a judge, and I know you're the judge here, okay? Let me make my defense. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship. He puts time into it. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone in the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. And they cannot prove to you the charges that they are now making against me. However, I admit that I do worship the God of our ancestors as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. So all of the accusations, he throws it at him. He says, look, this is not true, this is not true, this is not true. The one thing they got me is, I'm sorry, yes, I am a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. I champion Jesus Christ. And if that's why I'm here, then so be it, chop me. I believe everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets. And I have the same hope in God as these men themselves have, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. He connects himself with these guys who bring the accusations. He does not insult them. He connects with them. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Or those who are here should state what crime they found in me and when I stood in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin, unless it was this one thing that I shouted as I stood in their presence. It is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I'm on trial before you today. So why am I really here? It's like this is a really silly court case. Because the real people that should be there are not there. And you remember who they were? If you've been walking with us every Sunday night, these were Jews that followed Paul through Thessalonica. These are Jews that came from far away and they hated Paul and they were in Jerusalem when he was there. Those are the guys that should be there. These guys are talking about riots all over the world. Were you there? They weren't there. Those guys from the other places were there. They're supposed to be here. And then it's like, okay, what's the crime? What did I do in front of Sanhedrin? Was it this statement? It seems like Paul is producing evidence and true statements, and the other guys are just throwing accusations. Anyways, cool. Paul gets a fair trial here. He gets a moment to speak without being slapped. It's wonderful. And I've got to give Felix credit here. He's actually pretty fair. Gives him a chance to speak. But Paul does not patronize him. But he makes a statement in expectance that he will receive a fair trial, which is also wise. It's not a problem for him to defend himself. In fact, it's like Paul is saying, I'll do it with a smile. I've got no problem with defending myself. Why? Well, because the truth is on his side. The truth is on Paul's side. And every accusation these guys bring here cannot be backed up. I find it pretty cool that Paul says, you can verify. You can verify. Go check for yourself. The truth, ladies and gentlemen, fears no questions. Bring your questions. They have words, I have facts. 12 days ago, I went to Jerusalem. There was nothing in the news of me stirring up a crowd anywhere in the whole city. They cannot prove that I desecrated the temple. There's no evidence. I'm not guilty. They are wrong. Their accusations are false. Except this last thing that I do champion the Nazarite sect. from verse 17 to 21, it seems like he's just saying, let me elaborate further. I came to bring gifts to the poor and offer sacrifices. He's showing his motive. He didn't come here to bring trouble. He came to bring sacrifice and to help the poor. He was ceremonially clean. In other words, he didn't come to desecrate. If he really wanted to desecrate, he wouldn't have been ceremonially clean. There's no crowd with me. There's no disturbance. And the people who started the riot, they are not here today. And the other riot in the Sanhedrin, I don't know what crime I committed there except this one statement that I made, that I believe in the resurrection of the dead, when the people went nuts. So what is exactly my crime? I didn't start the riot. I did not desecrate the temple. So why am I here? Well, I suspect that we are awaiting a judgment and Paul is exonerated. Right? You think Paul's going to be set free, Brother Jack? I don't know. He made a good case. Who do you think wins here? Who's the best lawyer? They're both pretty good. It doesn't matter who's the best lawyer. What matters? What's the truth? What evidence is there? What evidence is there? Well, in anyways, let's see. Then Felix, verse 22, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. When Lysias the commander comes, he said, I will decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. Yes. You know what I think about when I read that? I think about poor Lysias. Can you imagine this guy? For crying in a bucket. Can we just get him guilty or not guilty, sort this out? When I go visit Felix again, I want us to have a cup of tea and just talk about life, not Paul again. Can this thing not get solved? Lysias is dragged into it again. It doesn't seem like he ever arrived, well, at least in the next 2 years. And once again, what do we see the conclusion of the matter? Stalemate. Stalemate. Felix wanted the Jews to be happy with him, but he also couldn't legally find Paul guilty. So he's in the middle. He couldn't make a decision, so he just let Paul stay there under palace arrest. Okay. Now the interesting part comes. So that's the decision, ladies and gentlemen. That's the decision. What happens next? And with everything said so far about Felix, I want you to imagine what's happening here. Several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. As Paul talked about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe. So he sent for him frequently and talked with him. Do you think that this might have something to do with why Paul is there in the first place? And why the case wasn't resolved immediately? Maybe these conversations would have never taken place. If he said, Paul, you exonerated, this is the end. Perhaps they were intrigued with Paul. He was an interesting case. And Felix brought his wife in because she was a Jew. And she might perhaps better understand, you know, the theology going on here. Not sure. The dad, as I said, was Herod Agrippa. So, now, the question is, Paul probably chose this topic because of the lax morality of this guy. He brought it up. They were both adulterers. And we know already, based on his actions after this, this was an evil man. And he brought up these three topics, righteousness, self-control, and the judgment in front of them. The text actually says that Paul reasoned with them. He had a rational conversation with them about these three topics. These are probably the most uncomfortable topics for them to listen to. It's interesting for me that people are always willing to talk about Jesus, faith in Jesus, you know, follow Jesus. But the moment you talk about sin, or that Jesus is going to judge you for what you've done, oh, okay, no, why, this is going too far now. Or that you are practicing unrighteousness, you are unjust, well, that feels uncomfortable. That's not convenient to talk about. So we push that out. We push them away. You might have gotten away with her husband. You might have gotten away from her husband. You might have snatched her away from her husband, but you're not going to get away from Jesus. Can you imagine what's going on in his mind? Because he's a superior person in the Roman government, he can do what he wants. He wants a wife, takes it. And Paul's like, buddy, there's a superior person to you. He's the ruler of the universe, and he's going to hold you accountable. You've taken another man's wife. You're an adulterer, and you've made her an adulteress. You're going to pay for this. If you were Felix, would you want to hear more? I don't want to hear more. Go. I'll call for you when I want you, when I want to talk to you again. So Paul probably had this God moment here. Lord, your plan is perfect. You brought me here to speak to the most powerful person in Judea, in Israel. You brought me to the most powerful ruler in this place. I think it's an incredible story how Paul is taken by God to Felix to talk to him about his moral life. That's incredible. Thank you, Lord, for using me. But what happens? Felix feels uncomfortable. The text says he trembles. He's fearing, either because he realizes that he's in darkness and sin and he's going to die and he's going to pay for his sin one day. Or maybe he fears, he's looking at his wife, Drusilla, thinking, I hope she doesn't leave me and go back to her husband. I hope she doesn't repent and leave me. Maybe that's one of the things that he feared. I don't know. But either way, for Felix, this is too hard to deal with. It's just too much. And I find it just classic. His words, when I find it convenient. When I find it convenient, then I will make time for Christ. When I find it convenient, I'll be committed to going to church. Or I'll be committed to reading my Bible. Or I'll be committed to prayer. When I find it convenient, I'll actually start doing what Jesus requires of me. When I find it convenient, I'll start making disciples. It's all about my convenience. And this is the difficulty in a very convenient world, where everything is surrounded by convenience. Interesting. The message was highly inconvenient. It was unacceptable. It cost too much. It was a thorn in the flesh. And maybe that's what this lady meant this morning when she said, well, yeah, we just say it as it is. Because sometimes if we're just going to preach the word, it is so uncomfortable. It's not nice to hear it. But we can't pick and choose what we're going to speak about here. If the text says it, then we've got to deal with it. So Paul is basically, I think, saying to this guy, look, you are not right. You are base. You cannot control your sexual urges, and you will be judged by God himself. But the true nature of this guy is revealed in verse 26. What does he want? Why does he call Paul back? Money. Money. It reveals his heart, doesn't it? Paul has just told him about doing what is right and good, and now he wants money from Paul. The text actually doesn't say bribe. It just says that he wanted money, but we know what that means. He wanted money from Paul. And he clearly misunderstood Paul. Let's be honest. I mean, when you meet Paul, what you read about in the Bible regarding Paul, if you meet Paul, do you think you're going to think, this guy's got money to give me? You'd be like, geez, he doesn't even have a rag to give me. He's got nothing. This guy's a peasant. He's nothing. If Paul did have money, what would he do? And perhaps that was in his mind. Well, Paul went all over the world and he collected all of this money from the churches and he brought it to Jerusalem to give to the poor. So Paul has got access to lots of people and lots of money. It's interesting in ministry, just a side note, How I've seen it so many times. You know, you have people that sell life insurance, or you have people that some type of investors, or when they find out I'm a preacher at a church, they immediately find tremendous interest in me. Why? Because if they can sell me their product or just introduce me to their product, I've got access to a whole group of people that I can sell or refer to them. It's interesting. Maybe this is what's going on here. Maybe Paul is poor, but he believes that if Paul really wanted to, he can get those wonderful brothers all over the world to send him some money to get him out of jail so he can go preach the gospel. See, but I mean, God doesn't need any money to get anybody out of prison. He can get him out of there tomorrow if he wanted to. That's who our God is. He didn't need money to be set free. But what is interesting for me, this strikes me. This is really interesting for me. Paul, okay, let me just pause for a moment. I mean, what would you do to spend an hour with Paul? The real deal. What do you do? Just sit and have a chat with him. Would you fly to the other side of the world to just have one conversation with him? Like, what's the person that you really want to go talk to when you get to heaven? Is Paul one of those guys? I would love to have a conversation with him. Check this out. Felix has Paul right there with him. The guy who practically authored most of the New Testament is right there with him. And Paul calls himself, well, he talks about his body as a sort of a clay jar, and he's got this treasure inside of him, which is the gospel. Paul is this most valuable and powerful treasure on planet Earth. And he's right there in Felix's street, living there. He could sit with him every day, have breakfast, lunch, and supper. But you know what he wanted from Paul? Not the gospel. He wanted money from the God. He could have access to waters of life, but he said, I want money from you. I hear it's a bad word, but I just have to say it. He was a retard. He was a mampara. The author of most of the New Testament lived near him, but he wanted money from him. He had access to God's wisdom. I think Felix is lying in the grave for the last 2,000 years, or wherever he is, Hades, and he kicks himself the whole time. Dang it, dang it, dang it. I had Paul right there. I could have listened. I could have learned. I could have known the God of heaven and earth, but I didn't. It's sad. It's sad. I'm going to make a point about that at the end. The last verse says, when 2 years had passed, verse 27, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. The names in the Bible. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. 2 years. Typical politician. He wanted to please the people, he wanted money, and he didn't care about personal morality. Does that sound like a politician? I'll repeat that. He wanted to please the people, he wanted money, and he didn't care about his personal morality. I wish that we could have a politician in this country that wanted to please God, didn't care about money, and had personal integrity. Imagine we had somebody like that as our president. And we have none of that now, it seems like. And this is exactly why Paul says, pray for your leaders. Pray for the government. Pray for kings and officials. When Paul says that to Timothy, he's not saying it like, well, it's the right thing to do. It's a cool thing to do. No, he's like saying, if we could extend that conversation with Paul, you'd be like, guys, listen, you haven't been there, but I have. I've been face to face having dialogue with governors and kings and rulers. I know how they think. I know what's going on in their chambers. I know what's going on in their personal lives. And I know how they feel, and I can tell you now that they are just humans that are in sin, in a particularly difficult situation with all the power, popularity, and the possessions. They need us to pray for them. They are surrounded by powers that we can't even imagine, because the tallest trees get the most wind, right? These guys, the spiritual, I think we don't understand how the spiritual the power of spiritual influence is for these people. It's crazy. Anyways, they need prayer. We need to pray for our politicians. Let me conclude. Some thoughts. Firstly, exoneration is more noble than accusation. It's easy to point people at fingers, to point fingers at people. Ask me. There are always three fingers pointing back, right? And it's so true. It's so silly, but so true. We've got to be careful of this. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If you accuse, you will be accused. That's the first thing. What happens when somebody says, oh, yeah, but you so-and-so-and-so. What's the first thing you want to do? Yeah, but you so-and-so-and-so. Oh, you talk to me about this, but look at you do that. Accusation invites accusation. Not a good idea. It's not what godly people do. Number two, don't fight your enemy with the same tools that he uses. Paul did this so well. He didn't play the lawyer game in there. He was just honest, straightforward, and he pointed to the evidence. He could have insulted those guys, couldn't he? What, I mean, let's think about it for a moment. What do you think he could have said about the Sanhedrin? You guys are willing to lie. You are liars. You guys were willing to kill or to allow killing and murder. So he could have pointed a lot of things. Felix, these guys are murderers, lying thieves. Could have said that. Hypocrites. They practice their religion. They don't know God. They don't love God. They don't care. He could have insulted them, but he chose not to climb into their character. So don't use the same tools. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8 says, to sum up, all of you be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. Don't return evil for evil or insult for insult, but give blessings instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit the blessing. Give blessings. When people throw curses, give blessings. When they hurl insults, then you hurl blessings to them. Number three, true conversion happens when people truthfully face and submit to the teachings of righteousness, self-control, and judgment. This is where the gospel intersects your life. Righteousness, the teaching of righteousness makes you realize how unrighteous you are. Self-control makes you realize how much you need God because your body is out of control so often. None of us, it doesn't matter what you say. I know none of us controls our body like we want to. This thing is crazy. It wants to eat stuff it shouldn't be eating. It wants to listen to stuff it shouldn't be listening to. It wants to think stuff it shouldn't be thinking. This body is a mess. And then thirdly, and the judgment makes you realize that unrighteousness will not escape God's eyes. God will see everything and he will judge everything. So these three topics are extremely uncomfortable. Righteousness, self-control, and judgment. But we have to face them. And the day that you became a Christian or you became a disciple of Jesus, you were baptized into Christ, that moment, did you deal with these three things? Because if you haven't, then there might be a shortage in your commitment and in your conversion. They have to be dealt with. This is what cuts to the heart. This opens up. It's real. Fourthly, Christianity is not a religion of convenience, but of commitment. It's clear that most churches, especially the televangelists or whatever they are, they don't teach these things. They don't easily teach these things. They might sugarcoat it a little bit, make it easier to eat, teachings of righteousness and self-control and judgment. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard these popular online teachers or TV preachers like Joel Osteen or whoever ever preach a sermon on the judgment day. Telling people, hundreds of thousands of people, God will judge you for what you've done with your life. That's a simple, that's not even just talking about sin. It's not talking about hell. It's just talking about judgment, that there's going to be an accounting. People don't talk about that. Why? Because it's uncomfortable. And the difficulty is, and you'll hear it now from a preacher, first time you'll hear this. The difficulty is, it's like, you can stand up and you can make sure that you always just preach comfortable stuff. And you know why you would want to do that? Because you are more interested in getting people into your church than into heaven. Because you can get them in here through comfortable preaching, right? And we can be loaded every weekend. Yeah, and the budget could be great. And the people is nice and nice social. It's fantastic because it's convenient for everybody. And that's why people, that's why, honestly, this is why preachers want to avoid these topics. Because you know people are offended. And I've seen it. I mean, people have come here and they've left. Because it's offensive. And let me just say this. There's a difference between really being offensive when it's unnecessary and just saying what the text says, and then that's offensive. So, the teaching of the cross only becomes bearable when you're willing to bear it. It costs to follow Jesus. You got to take up your cross. It takes courage and commitment to obey Jesus. It is not a religion that you want to follow if you want to take it easy. It requires your whole soul, your whole body, your whole mind. And if anybody tells you anything else, it's a lie. Either come to Jesus with everything that he says, with everything that you have, and you follow him, or rather just don't. And then lastly, thank you, brother. A delay is a rejection. I didn't like this. I don't like this type of teaching, but it's in the text and I have to repent regarding it as well. Felix became afraid because of the gospel. He feared. I don't like breathing fire into people and making them fear, but that's essentially what the gospel does. It makes you become sober. He knew he was in trouble and didn't have the humility to make a change. Felix delayed his decision regarding Paul, but he also delayed his decision regarding Jesus. Because he said no to Jesus. He said, I'm not going to make a judgment now on whether I'm going to follow Jesus or not. And I'm not going to make a judgment now whether Paul should stay in prison or not. So I'm delaying it. A delayed decision is a rejection. You are either in or you are out. You're either hot or you are cold. The lukewarm section, it doesn't exist. And many people respond to the gospel this way. It's like, yeah, I'm sort of in, but sort of not. If you're sort of in and sort of not, then you're rejecting it. It is what it is. 2 Corinthians 6 verse 2 says, now is the day of salvation. Now. Felix had his opportunity with Paul in front of him. He chose to delay. That's a rejection. If you hear the gospel, you see your sin, and you realize your depravity, and you fear, there's only one response. Repent. Repent. Don't delay, because it might be the last time that you hear the warning from God. And certainly, it seems like that was the last opportunity that Felix had to make his life right with God. And we'll see what happens further next week. I went on too long again tonight.